Accession number 7480, room.
Mr. Jeffrey, accession number 403, rear one. Thank you, Mr. Jeffrey, for accepting our interview. Now, would you like to tell us a bit more about your personal background?
Yes. I was Reginald Jeffries, and I was born on October the 18th, 1909, of English parents in Derby, Derbyshire. Went to the council school at Derby, excellent in maths. They're interested in all sports, particularly in running, football, hockey, and etc. Served a full engineering apprenticeship at a general, at a big, large engineering firm, and got my certificate. Had 12 months unemployment after that because times was very... Oh, we'll get to that, yeah. All right.
It's all right.
Is it? Yeah. Yes. Anyway, carried on with engineering, working for... after my apprenticeship, I worked to Rolls-Royce at Derby and worked on the aero engines, which was fitted in the Spitfires and those sort of things during the war there. From there, my parents then moved south because my mother suffering from asthma, and we were told we had to move south from Derby to get into the warmer weather. So, of course, I wanted to go with them, which I did. So I got a job at the Admiralty torpedo factory at Weymouth, which was Whitehead's Torpedoes. And the irony of it was that some of the torpedoes that we were making, there was for the Japanese Navy. After that, during my holidays, I was very keen on motorcycling, and I went over on the continent on my motorcycle and toured all the way. Yes, all right, I'm just putting this in. This is what I'm going to go on that in a minute.
Yes, about the motorcycle on the continent.
Yes, this is just starting the... on the motorcycle on the continent, and during that time I noticed that war was going to be inevitable as the Germans... It's all right, now you're telling me off. On coming back from Germany, I decided that war was going to take place. I had made up my mind that war was going to take place within the next 12 months. So I thought I'd like to join the Navy if I was going to get called up. But I was already on a reserve occupation, so I wouldn't have been really called up. So anyway, I joined the Navy. I went to Dorchester, to the recruiting office there. I did the exams there, and I was sent to Portsmouth, to Whale Island, to do my trade test and do my exams. I passed these and was inevitably brought into the Navy. I was taken to HMS Excellent at Portsmouth. And Oh dear, I'm getting a bit mixed up one way or another.
You're not reading it.
Can we start again? Are you ready?
Yeah.
After passing my examinations, a 2-month trade test was taken at HMS Excellent on Whale Island. At Portsmouth, where I passed and was accepted into the Navy, where I took 3-month disciplinary course then at HMS Victory at Portsmouth, doing my disciplinary course. After completing the disciplinary course, I was then made acting petty officer. I then put in to join the Navy as an artificer, ordnance artificer, and I was made a temporary acting ordnance artificer, 4th class.
Can you remember your training as an artificer officer?
Oh, yes. I can remember the training. It was done at Whale Island. We was on course then for 12 months before I was sent to sea. During that period, for some unknown reason, I was given the job of marching all the artificer training there, backwards and forwards to the schools and different places there, which I thought was quite a start. Now then. When war broke out, just before war broke out, I was sent then to HMS Pembroke. To Pembroke, Chatham, to do 1 year's Ordnance Artificers course. After completing the course, I went to Greenock, Scotland, and joined the battle cruiser HMS Repulse. Mm-hmm. No battle experience prior to joining the Repulse. The ship was very large and with a complement of about 1,500 men. The ship had no radar, and the armament consists of 4 twin 15-inch turret guns, several batteries of 4-inch guns, 2 8-barrel pom-poms, 1 4-barrel pom-pom, and several 4-inch guns which could be used for angle firing. and then I get on the 5.
Please continue.
Discipline was upheld, although ratings could not approach an officer except through his superior rating. They were overcrowded while the officers had their own cabins, much better and even better food. Food was rationed, therefore there was a lot of discontent. Well, you see, this is a point there. Now then, is that right? Now, the mission to Singapore.
I'm sorry, Mr. Jeffrey. Before we go ahead for that topic, can I just go back to the shape of repulse?
Yes.
At that time, you were considered as petty officer. So, were you classified as officer and have the same living conditions with the officer?
Oh, no. 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 When you're a petty officer in the Navy, you're about equivalent to a sergeant in the army. Well, a little bit more. I think it's about a staff sergeant in the army when you're fully confirmed petty officer. And a chief petty officer, well, in the Navy, he ranks round about the warrant officer class. But you're not a commissioned officer. And I never was a commissioned officer, although I finished up as chief ordnance artificer there. That most of the officers, as far as the Navy is concerned, they come from Dartmouth and they start at midshipman and they go through like that. It's very difficult, although it's easier during the war, to get a commission.
Then what about the working relationships among the crews?
In the Navy at that particular period, their discipline was very strict, and you could only approach an officer through your next superior up, and it went up like that. You couldn't talk to the captain or the commander or anybody like that. You'd have to go through your divisional officer.
Mm-hmm. But then among the people with the same rank, how good was the working relationships with other people?
Well, naval officers at that particular time were not the same as they are today. Their discipline was very strict and it was kept that way. Now then.
But for example, your own crews, what was the working relationship between you and your crews member?
Well, my working relations with the ordnance officer there, who was an ex-boy artificer and put in for a commission there, because I found out I was a direct entry, the ordnance officer told me, he said, you will never get anywhere in the Navy because you were not trained at the artificer's establishment. So I thought myself, well, we'll see what we can do about that. Mm-hmm. Yes. Now.
Then about your training as an artificer officer. And what type of aircrafts did you deal with during your training?
Oh, we don't. We didn't, nothing to do with aircraft. The Fleet Air Arm had their own air artificers. I belonged to the Navy as the sailing Navy, and we were carried on board ships to maintain the guns, all type of guns, all the loading cycles, all the fire control systems and everything that goes with it. That was our job. The relationship with the other men was very good. We all worked together, as we all knew that we had a job to do, and if we didn't do our job properly, somebody else would do it, and then it would escalate right down the ranks there. So everybody pulled their weight. There, and especially at sea, if you had any extra, anything went wrong or anything like that, you didn't say, right, I'm finished at office four. You just carried on until you finished it. Sometimes we used to work right through the night. Mm-hmm. We'd work through the day until we got everything right. For one thing, which was certain, that we knew our lives were at stake there, and unless we kept things up to date there, then of course we knew we would never come through the war.
But then you mentioned the discontent.
Oh, there always was a certain amount of discontent in the Navy at that time between the lower and the upper deck, for the simple reason, as you can see, in the Navy, the Navy was, at that particular time, was for officers only. There, they didn't have very little time for anybody below the upper deck. There, it seemed as though the officers had all the room in the ship, and everybody else didn't have any. We didn't do so bad there, but we used to, we had artificers' mess there, but even then we were still crowded. In the Navy in those particular days there was no such things as easy chairs in our mess, and we all sat down at a bench-like table and those sort of things, where the officers, they had wardroom, messmen and everything. We didn't expect the same thing. We knew we wouldn't get it.
But can you describe how do you sleep if your mess was so crowded?
Oh, yes. Because the reason for our messes being so crowded was that, you see, everybody more or less was double-banked there. In other words, if you go into action and you get killed, then there's somebody got to step up into your job. Mm-hmm. That is the general rule. And that's why you carry a bigger complement than what you would in peacetime. Mm-hmm. Because you can't be replaced thousands of miles, or even hundreds of thousands of miles at sea, right in the middle of the ocean. The ship's got to carry on.
So now, could we move to the mission to Singapore?
Yes. Now, the Repulse, being the the second biggest ship in the Navy. There was three battle cruisers. The Hood, which blew up, the Repulse, and the Renown. I served on the two. I served on the Renown afterward until they decided to scrap the battleships. The Repulse, I thought, was a terrific size ship. Overcrowded to a certain degree. They're overrun with cockroaches in some places. There, which we used to have, especially when we went out east. There, the cockroaches we used to find there under the lapels of our uniform. So, we used to have a few rats running around, but otherwise not too bad. We didn't have very much time for any play or anything like that. It would seem to be all work. But of course, being a war on, that's just what you expected. Now, we did think, and we did think that the ship was not really fitted out to go anywhere near where we were likely to run into aircraft. As we were fitted out for surface firing, ships on surface, there we was very well equipped for that, but we lacked anti-aircraft guns, and this eventually proved to be our downfall.
Now, how did you know that you had to sail for the east?
We were told we were going to escort a convoy down as a guardship round the Cape there with supplies and men for the 8th Army. We could no longer use the Mediterranean, as Rommel was somewhere near the Suez Canal there, and every time we went through the Med, we all got bombed up and we lost a lot of ships there. So we had to go all the way around Africa. Now, I'd only been on the ship a few months when we undertook this voyage. We sailed from Greenock in Scotland, at the mouth of the Clyde. There. We were to pick up the convoy just off the coast of Scotland, which we did. We had five destroyers with us as escort, and also to protect the convoy. Now, when we sailed that morning, the heavy mist came down there, and you couldn't see many yards in front of you. And particularly during the voyage, on one occasion, there we nearly touched one of the ships in the convoy. We were that close to it. I happened to be on the upper deck, having a little bit of fresh air, and saw this ship looming up alongside of it. Ammunition ship too. There, anyway, we were protected all the way then by this sea mist. you couldn't go straight. You couldn't go straight south, and to miss the submarine, it meant the convoy, and the speed of the convoy, which was the slowest speed of the ship, any of the ships in the convoy. We all had to keep together, and there were dozens of ships. I'd never seen anything like it. And during that time, the German aircraft picked us up, and they were only very, very, flying very low, trying to peer through the mist to bomb us, which they couldn't do because they couldn't see us. I don't know.
Then, after you picked up the convoy, you sailed to Cape Town?
Yes, we didn't stop at Cape Town. We carried on round the Cape, and the convoy was halted outside Durban there. And we sailed into Durban Harbour. We sailed up to Durban there, where we took on supplies and oil fuel, as we needed quite a lot of oil fuel. The Repulse having 42